Hey, if you enjoyed my episode on IEPs and you want to listen to more podcast episodes about IEPs, I want to tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season, the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ertube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. You might have heard me talk about IEPs on my episode, and this latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. I checked out these episodes, and I think that they are a great place for you to go after listening to mine. They go into a little more detail and answer a little more in depth about what an IEP is and whether your child needs one. So listen to Understood Explains by searching for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. Hello, you sentient balls of stardust. Welcome back to Struggle Care. I'm your host, Casey Davis, and today we are going to talk about when the church gaslights women. I'm here with Dr. Andrew Bauman. Andrew, I came across your stuff the other day as I was sort of looking at things. I'm currently writing a book about relationships for myself. I guess I would consider myself a deconstructed Christian. And here's what kind of hit me as very different than the things that I've seen before. Like, I'm just kind of scrolling through your page about some blog posts, and the first thing that comes up is on weaponizing forgiveness. And I had literally just written a chapter about this, so I was like, oh, interesting. And then, of course, the next thing is marriage, no matter what, is idolatry. And then a picture of equality, and then abuse in the Protestant church, and practicing full consent. And I mean, just kind of on, you know, having boundaries against spiritual manipulation. And these are, to me, very refreshing things to hear. But I think you would admit it's not something we are used to hearing from someone who is a self-proclaimed Christian, especially a male Christian leader.
Yes, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah, I've kind of came at this conversation a little differently. I was a pastor before I was a therapist. And so I was on the other side. I was, in a sense, on the other team, part of a Southern Baptist church, part of the boys club. And we kind of held the keys to the kingdom, right? I held the power and I liked it. It felt good until I began my studies as a therapist and began to deconstruct my own faith, until I began to deconstruct scripture more fully, and then realizing my own power, my own depravity, my own darkness, and then even undoing my own kind of sexuality and my own history of kind of pornography, objectification of women, and then realizing patriarchy and how much my theology had been intertwined with subjugation of women, and just like, oh my, I've got a lot of work to do. I've got a lot of things I need to untangle, right? Because who we are sexually is who we are spiritually, and vice versa. And so I had a lot of work to do. So that's kind of what I've been doing the last 20 years of my life, kind of untangling all this and then realizing, wow, like, I've done a lot of harm. I don't want to be an abuser of women too. I want to be an advocate of women. So I came to this conversation kind of differently than most, but now I feel like, yeah, it is my calling. It is what I do as a therapist, working with kind of at the intersection of abuse and unwanted sexual behaviors and all those forms. And currently finishing up a book called Safe Church, How to Guard Against Sexism and Abuse Christian Communities.
Well, that's really powerful. And I have so many thoughts that kind of hit me all at once. You know, you say, you know, you came to it differently, but it seems so similar to some of my experience. I mean, I came to the church, I got sober when I was 16, so I didn't grow up a believer at all. I had this kind of intense spiritual experience when I was 16 while I was institutionalized, and I got sober after that, and then fell into a church and converted to Christianity. And that church was very heavy on the idea that, you know, wives submit to your husbands and things like that, and women shouldn't lead and all this, which was a weird position to be in with a woman of my personality, because I had done nothing but lead everywhere I went because that's my personality. That's just what always happened. And I went to seminary, and people underestimate how radicalizing conservative seminary is, because, you know, you get there and you expect these people to be like, yes, it says this. And they'd be like, no, we don't really know. Yeah, no, it probably doesn't say that. And you have people at the church level that will take phrases or things like, you know, okay, wives, submit to your husbands. And they'll kind of, they'll explain it in a way where they'll explain away all the problematic parts of it. They'll be like, no, 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 what Paul really meant is this. And the, see, the Greek word for submit is this. And we can also see this over here. So actually what it is, and they'll totally like redefine the word into something that seems more godly. And I was like, yes, okay, that makes sense. I love it, right? And then I get to seminary to like a real biblical scholar who'll be like, nah, man, that's not what he meant. He for sure meant obey. He for sure meant you were property. And you'll be like, wait, so what does that mean? And like, and some of the more honest scholars would just like look at me and be like, oh, fucking no, dude. I don't know. I don't know what we do with that. And so it was a weird to come back to church and be like, hey guys, that's not what this means. And then also to see the fruits of that belief. Like I saw many families and couples go into counseling where the woman was just battered. I don't mean from her husband, I mean by the church, trying to do church discipline. And she comes out wounded and leaves the church completely because they mistreated her. And they and I remember looking at this and being like, I can't help but think that, and to be fair, the church that I would come out constantly and apologize, like the church I went to, I think was trying to do the right thing. And then they would recognize they had been a little too rough in the handling. They hadn't done it right. And they'd come out and apologize. And I remember just thinking like, you know, guys, like at what point are you going to realize that this may not keep happening over and over if you were to put women in positions of leadership?
Representation. Yes, no doubt. No doubt. So part of my studies for the last 3 years was I did a questionnaire of over 2,800 women who worked in the church and their experience of sexism and abuse. And so we have some hard data of what their experience is, sexism and abuse. And what I found was over 82% of women experienced some form of abuse, sexism or abuse in their church experience. 62% would not be surprised if they heard a sexist joke from the pulpit. Right. So I've got a lot of those little stats now of like, this is rampant, right? The stories that I heard from the in-depth interviews that I did are horrific, horrific, horrific. I mean, just nauseating stories of what these women experienced. The comments on their bodies, right? The comments on basically just the sexualization of their bodies, blaming them, right, for what they're wearing versus the pastors dealing with their own sexuality, their own arousal structures, right? Just blaming the women for their own arousal. These stories are everywhere. It is truly just absurd how women have been gaslighted, blamed, when this, I truly believe this is a male issue, right? 90% of churches are led by men, over 90%.
And I think even the good ones, like I always tell people that, you know, I didn't go to a church that talked poorly about women from the pulpit. Like they were doing all sorts of, you know, mental gymnastics to make these problematic thing, you know, to, okay, men need to be respectful. They need to be this, you need to be that. And so like, but I think that makes my stories important because it's easy to say, oh, that's just the churches that are bad. That's just the churches that are abusive. And like, that wasn't my experience. Like my experience was like, I remember I had taken a trip to Guatemala City because there was a partner church down there. And the pastor that was leading the trip, he and I became friends and we had really complimentary personalities. We were joking all the time. We were friends. We really respect each other. I had, I think, more seminary experience than he did at that point. I did like 5 years of an MDiv and then switched to a counseling degree. So I ended up being a therapist as well. And Guatemalan churches don't take the whole like women can't teach thing as seriously. And so they had asked me to put together a Bible study. I was living down there at the time and I wrote this whole study, this course on how to study the Bible. And he had come down on a trip and he sat into one of my classes and I asked him what he thought. And I'll never forget his response to me was, it was, the material was so good and your teaching is so great. And I just couldn't get past how uncomfortable I was being taught by a woman. And I asked him, are you uncomfortable because you feel like you are doing something unbiblical, or are you uncomfortable because
it feels emasculating to be taught by a woman or something like that. And he was able to honestly say to me, like, no, it has nothing to do with like conviction. I just like, it just feels weird and uncomfortable and I don't like it. And I was like, oh, I can never be actually respected in this environment.
Exactly. And like your story is probably so many women's stories. And it sounds like you have been able to leave that behind and step into that. And yet so many women most likely have not had the strength that you had to leave that behind, where you have now developed a platform and you've been able to speak and step into your glory and into your strength. And yet so many women have had to battle for that, to be seen, to step into their goodness. And it's so sad. I mean, it's so heartbreaking.
When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we're alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes a life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future no longer is a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean when you have a child to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath. Shout out to Claritin for giving me some free samples and for sponsoring this podcast. I am a seasonal allergy sufferer, which means that sometimes I'm lying in bed reading a book that is super happy and my husband says, what's wrong? Why are you crying? Because I am sniffling and he thinks I'm crying. But no, it's just seasonal allergies. Luckily, that does not happen anymore because I use Claritin D. We can live Claritin clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sniffing, sneezing, watery eyes, itchy nose and throat. It's great. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. As for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter, you don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. Use as directed.
I still remember where I was the first time it hit me. I maybe do have ADHD. And it's funny, I posted a TikTok the other day about having ADHD, and a good friend of mine texted me and said, remember when you swore to me you didn't have ADHD? Oh, goodness. Well, listen, if you relate to that at any point in your life, I want to share a podcast that you should tune into. It's called ADHD Aha, hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. In each episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways that ADHD symptoms can surface for adults. And it doesn't always look the way we thought it would. So check it out. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha, with Aha spelled A. H-A.
You know, what's interesting, though, is like, I don't even think it was about me being strong. Like, I will say this, and this is like a weird thing to say around this narrative, but like, when I married my husband, he was pretty devout, but he was not churched. He didn't like church. He didn't like any of that stuff. And he was really the one that gave me this picture of, you can hold on to your faith and walk away from this church nonsense, from the way this is being structured. And I think that that has more to do with it than like strength, because people don't have that lighthouse. People think that their choices are to leave the faith completely, right? Or chew it whole. And I think that's why it's so important that people like you exist, because yes, there are lots of really great therapists out there that you can go to that will say to you and validate, like, I want to leave this faith, or like, this faith is toxic and this, that, and the other. And I'm not even saying that that's not true. And I think that people who deconstruct to the point of leaving the faith completely are valid. And there are people who don't want to leave the faith completely. And I think it's important that people stay in the faith so that they have somewhere to go.
Totally. Well said. I remember when I was working at the church and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, came to the church to meet my pastor buddies. And my wife was in seminary at the time, very strong, articulate woman. She comes, meets everybody. And I remember my pastor buddy says, well, Andrew, don't you want more of like, you know, a helpmate, somebody who will support your ministry, you know, your dreams? And I was like, huh? Like, what? Why do I have to somehow, like, why does she have to be less? Why do I have to be that insecure? I wanted an equal. I wanted a partner who will inspire me, right? And my wife, as her PhDs, written multiple books, and like, that's what I wanted, because that's what I wanted in my life too. And I have that as well, right? And so, and we're both running very fast, and we both have a lot of like that. I wanted to be inspired by my partner, right? I didn't like,
I mean, that person said the quiet part out loud, didn't they? Because they'll say all day long, no, like men and women are equal. It's just a different role. But you are so right. I literally remember asking one time, I was in a conservative seminary and there was a guy that I liked, just like as a friend. And I remember asking him, hey, why is it that y'all never date seminary students? You never date the female seminary students. Like, you guys, I was like, I don't mean to be rude, but like, it seems like you guys tend to only date like very undereducated church girls. And he was like, well, think of it this way. This conversation will be etched into my brain forever, Andrew. If you play football for a living and you just play football all day, you leave it out on the field, you don't really want to come home and play more football. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, you genuinely like don't want a smart woman. Like, he was trying to say that, like, you know, I'm doing this intellectually rigorous, you know, thinking and theology and da 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 during the day. And like, I don't want to do that. I don't want that in a partner. Which was like so, so hard for me, because like, no matter what, like, I am extroverted. I am a theater major. I have ADHD. Like, I was never going to be less intelligent, less out loud, less of a strong personality. And I love to look back on that now, because my husband now is like Mensa level, freakish, Goodwill Hunting smart. Like, so much smarter than any guy I ever met in seminary. And we're talking like graduate first in his class from a top 15 law school smart, like the smartest man I have ever met, like find quadratic equations scribbled on napkins smart. But like you, he wanted that. He wanted a person that was equal to him. He wanted a person that could challenge him, that he could admire. He didn't want to just be admired.
Totally. And I knew my darkness, meaning like I have a very strong personality, right? And I know I can, in a sense, dominate. I can power over. Like, that's part of my darkness. I don't want to do that. I don't want to abuse my strength or abuse my power. I want someone who can take me on, because I have a propensity to dominate or power over. And I don't want to do that. So I want another strong personality that I know I won't be able to do that. Like, if we know our darkness, if we know who we are, in a sense, we can know, like, yes, this is what I need in my life, because this, I want to continue to stay. I need a good partner. I need a partner.
I want to go back to something you said earlier that I kind of bookmarked, is you said something to the effect of how we are in our sexuality is how we are in our spirituality. What was that phrase?
Yeah, just basically, you know, we can't split ourselves. Basically, I feel like who we are sexually represents who we are in every area of life, who we are spiritually, right? We can't say, oh, I'm super healthy emotionally, and then we're super unhealthy spiritually, or I'm super spiritually healthy, and then you're super emotionally unhealthy. They all tie together. We can't just split. We try to, you know, somehow have a secret sexual life, and then we're, you know, this really good Christian person. Like, no, we are human. We are one. We can't just split off.
Because the reason I bookmarked it is because I felt like you could hear it either way. Like, it sounded like it could be similar to what people have heard, where it's like, hey, your sexuality is the most important thing about you, and it's going to damn you to hell, and like, you cannot be a Christian if you don't have a certain sexuality. But I didn't think you meant it that way, but I did want to clarify, because I could hear somebody hearing it that way, but what I hear you saying is you cannot mask your derision of half of the people of God under this like convenient theological structure and think that's not going to affect your emotional, spiritual health.
Exactly. Yes. Well said. Exactly. No, I mean, the men that I work with who have hidden, many of them have hidden sexual lives or cheating on their partners or having these extramarital affairs, and they're, you know, going to acting like they're great Christian guys, and, you know, they have these separate lives and they're thinking that they're somehow these good guys, you know. And it's like, no, like, you are what you hide. Your secrets do define who you are in your character. And so what does it mean to have full integrity is to be fully integrated. And so that's kind of what I mean in that. And I did want to revisit what you were talking about around the sexism in the church. You know, what you're describing as hostile sexism, I think it's important. Basically, most churches do not demonstrate the hostile form of sexism, which is basically this blatant. I remember this pastor in 2001, he made some comment about, I don't know if it was in the news, but some Melania Trump. He said something about, you know, every woman can't be a big trophy wife like Melania Trump. He said it's from the pulpit. Anyway, some gross thing. Like, that's like just straight up hostile sexism, right? That's a most churches aren't going to do that, right? And so don't just dismiss, oh, my church doesn't say that, so they're not sexist. Many churches, I'm not going to say most, but they demonstrate a benevolent sexism or an ambivalent sexism. So there's a difference, or it's much more passive, which makes it much more difficult to for women to see or men to see, because it's not, well, no, they're not basically, you know, actively hostile towards women. And so it's just important to define what that is. But if women, yeah, are not in leadership, or they're defining certain scriptures in a certain way that's blatantly sexist. And so there are a few problem scriptures that outright, they seem quite sexist outright. And I just wanted to address a few of those if you feel like that would be helpful to your audience. A couple of the kind of the most problematic scriptures. So what I would like to do, if it would be helpful for you, is to kind of, as an emotional exercise, I just want to read a couple of these scriptures, and I just want you to kind of take a few deep breaths, and then just we'll check in with your body. And I'd like just to feel what you feel emotionally in your body, physically, just from feeling these scriptures. Okay. Take a few deep breaths in through your nose, out through your mouth. We'll start with a classic one. 1 Timothy 2:11-12. A woman is to learn quietly with full submission. I do not allow a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. Instead, she is to remain quiet. Take a deep breath. Breathe out. What has come up for you?
You want feelings or thoughts?
Let's start with feelings.
Betrayal.
Mm-hmm. What else?
I think that's the biggest one.
Okay.
And sadness.
Yeah. If you read that just in that context, right, that, I mean, that can be so weaponized, right? What do you feel like betrays you with that verse?
I think one of the things that I always struggled with before I kind of found my space is that there is a cultural prescription from first century Judaism and before that shows up in the scriptures about what makes a woman a worthy person. And it's always connected to her femininity. And her femininity is always narrowly described as being submissive and quiet and meek and gentle. And I have never naturally been any of those things.
Which means if that were true, then somehow you would miss the mark on you being an authentic woman or something.
Yeah. And it's one of the, it's like this deep shame that a man is wrong by what he does, but a woman is wrong by what she is. And that I am fundamentally undesirable as a woman. And so if you connect that to the large emphasis on marriage and how we all need to be getting married, and that's like the best thing you could do, you know, okay, well, who's going to want me if I'm not those things? And many of them didn't, because I wasn't those things. And so there's this weird disconnect of, okay, like, I got sober sitting on a bench in Oklahoma, staring out at the sunset, feeling as though, even though I didn't believe in God, I was being visited by the presence of God. Like, that's what won me over, was this like tenderness and this realization of, I feel so unworthy and that's okay. Not even like, no, you're good enough. It's like, oh, I mean, maybe you aren't, but you're still loved. And that love will make you feel enough. And it'll be okay to be not perfect. And it'll be okay to be not broken. And it'll be okay to be not, you know, perfect like everybody else or like everybody else. And so this felt experience of what it felt like to encounter God on my own terms and in my own way was radically different than the way that I encountered those scriptures, that I encountered the men using those scriptures to say, actually, the core of who you are is undesirable.
And there's, again, so much pain and grief in that for in your journey. I just feel the grief and so glad that's not where you landed. Like, that's not the end of the story.
And like some of it, I feel this sort of like, you know, now that I have left the church and, you know, it's funny, I became a stay-at-home mom. I just wanted to stay at home with my babies. And I ended up just starting a little TikTok channel and talking. And then all of a sudden the TikTok channel blew up and I was talking about mental health. And then I wrote a book and then I got a book deal. And then I did a TED talk. And then I did, every time I walk on stage, I think back to my church and I think, you could have had this. I could have been doing this for you, but you didn't want it. There was no place for me to go. There was no place for me to go. And so now I'm doing it out here. Like, there was no life in which I wasn't going to be on a stage. And I don't mean that egotistical. There was no life in which I wasn't going to have a loud voice and a strong leadership and an intelligence that wanted to speak to people, but you didn't want it.
Exactly. And what your pastor buddy felt, right, of being uncomfortable is because you were so damn good. It's because you were so skilled. And he was like blown away and felt so insecure, most likely.
And it's weird to feel like you've had, like, people laugh all the time. I made a TikTok recently where I talked about how I pick and choose which parts of the Bible I believe are accurate. And everyone was like, well, you can't do that. And I was like, no, no, what you need to understand is that everyone does. The most like sola scriptura, we only go by the text, like they're doing it too. Like anyone who tells you that Paul didn't mean submit to be obey is lying. Anyone that tells you that rape is not seen in the Old Testament as a property crime against a man is being disingenuous. That is what the authors meant. And so like we're all picking and choosing. I'm just going to choose to pick and choose by a different metric. And it's weird to have this like, so anyways, but so people will always be like, so then why do you believe in like, then if you can admit how problematic the religion is, why do you still believe in a Christian God? And every time I answer, because I met him on a bench once. Like I can no more make myself disbelieve in him than, you know, probably somebody listening could make themselves believe.
Yes, it's well said. Well said. I just wanted to thank you for sharing that. I wanted to go back to the 1 Timothy passage that's so triggering, has been used to weaponize so much. And just a few things I wanted to add there, which, again, part of the translation that is so screwed up that we've added. The word quietly in that passage, again, my Greek is not good, Heshua, it doesn't mean silence, it means stillness. Do you see how different a peacefulness, a stillness, rather than silence? Women should learn to be still, not silence, not silencing women for all time, but we should learn in stillness. The word authoritative, I mean, authoritian is what the word means. It's a loose translation Greek word. The origin of the word relates to abusing one's power or misusing authority. This is the only time this word was used in the Bible in relation to a unique position that Paul was addressing directly in the letter to Timothy. Basically, as you go on and you see some of the early church, some of the context, a lot of the scholars will say a few women, because the early church was going against the patriarchal culture, some of the women were so excited that they were finally being given a voice. They were going against the norm, that they were disrupting some of the early services, that there were a couple women that were so pumped because they could finally have a voice and they were being disruptive. And they were writing, Paul was writing to that church, hey, stop it, you two ladies that are so pumped that you can finally talk and be respected. And I love that version of that, of like, hey, you two women, like, stop being so disruptive. Go home, talk to your husbands about it because you guys are equals. Like, discuss it with them. Versus silencing all women of all time to be quiet. Like, I love that little shift of like, what if that is actually the intent of that original passage of just like, hey, you two women. And yet what we've taken it, how it's been translated of like, all like, what if we actually have got it all wrong? What if we've got it all wrong? I love some of those unique scripture, just looking at scripture in a different way. And that Paul, though, yes, some of his things are a bit, but like, I actually think some of the study that I've done of the early church women, the church is, I mean, if we just look at Jesus and the way Jesus engages women, it's so opposite of what the culture at that time does to women.
Do you think, so when I listen to that, and I've never looked into those words, it doesn't sound less sexist to me.
Say more.
And like, which is fine. And I think if I were to put that together with like the other things that Paul says, even when you can like dial down the intensity a bit by like understanding context, what I have found freeing is the idea that like, the idea that this man would, I mean, like your own story about how much unpacking you had to do from like the cultural, both inside and outside the church, like the cultural misogyny and the cultural patriarchy, like we don't have any indication of Paul like doing that, except around a few cases, you know, neither Greek nor Jew kind of thing, neither man nor woman, like certainly within the equality before God, he does that.
And him calling, you know, other women, Juna, Phoebe, calling them co-workers, you know, that sort of thing. Basically fighting for equality. But yes, in other ways, he's calling them equals.
Yeah. I just wonder, like, is there not space for us to say these words are important, they are important testimony, and there are probably ways in which culturally we have progressed farther than Paul himself?
Yep.
And to be like, yeah, man, like that is what Paul said. Here's the context. It's not quite what you think it is. But even so, what the hell does that have to do with you trying to shepherd the women in your church?
Right. And could Paul have still been sexist? And could Paul still be awesome? Both can be true.
So let me ask you about a few points that you have talked about before. And one is this idea of weaponizing forgiveness. Can you talk a bit about how forgiveness gets weaponized in church?
Yeah, basically, it's so common, right? A wife will go to her pastor and talk about an affair, talk about secret porn use, talk about this, and the immediate response will be, have you forgiven him? As somehow, the deceptive sexuality, the lying, the lack of integrity is not the issue. I'm not going to focus on the deception or the lack of integrity. I'm going to focus on the forgiveness. I'm going to make it the woman's fault, right? I'm going to make it about what you're wearing. I'm going to make it rather than confronting the actual issue, rather than confronting the man, right? And I think there's a lot around that. One, Barna did a study 2014 that showed like 50% of pastors had some type of relationship with porn, which means they have some type of relationship with shame, most likely, because most of that's hidden, right? So then what do they do? Instead of admit their own shame, they're going to project that onto women, right? Make it about modesty, make it about other things, right? I'm not going to make it about my own shame and be honest with my own darkness, my own lies, my own lack of integrity. I'm not going to confront other men. I'm going to project it outward and blame women. I'm going to make women the issue, right? So that's cool.
You know, what's interesting about that too, is that it doesn't even touch the idea that the vast majority of pornography that's put out specifically is misogynist. Like the amount of pornography that is very heavy towards infantilizing the woman, towards humiliating or degrading a woman, all the way down to one of the things that I notice is like the noises that women make in like 85% of pornography that is directed towards men are indistinguishable from sounds of pain and discomfort and like non-consent.
Yes.
Like I have noticed that where I'm like, I don't sound like that during sex. You know what I mean? Like this sort of little girl, I don't like it, but oh, but maybe I do. Like even all the way down to the kind of grunting that's used.
Well,
is specific to this like little girl being violated. And that can't not shape your view of women.
Exactly. Exactly. So it creates a pornographic mindset. It creates what I call a pornographic style of relating. And Dr. Anna Bridges out of Arkansas, I believe the University of Arkansas, did a study that showed, they studied the over 300 most popular porn videos, and they showed it was like 85% of them showed violence against women. Right. Out of those 85%, 90% of those videos showed women either enjoying the violence or being passive, being not like either, you know, either enjoying it or being complacent about the violence. Right. So what is that teaching us? Right. And then so back to the church, then you have church and pastors, some engaging in that. Right. So, of course, that's going to impact how they engage femininity, how they engage masculinity, how they talk about domestic violence, right? It's like it's all going to, so you're not hearing lots of sermons about domestic violence. And yet one out of three women experience some type of sexual violence. One out of four women experience some type of domestic violence, right? And so, but if it's coming from a male lens, well, I'm not experiencing domestic violence. Well, I'm not experiencing sexual violence at that rate. So I'm not going to talk about it, right? And when you don't have the representation, when you don't have women in leadership, right? And so I remember one of the women from my study who was sexually abused by a church leader. You know, she went as she was a teenager. She went to the church leadership to, you know, say what happened in the sexual abuse. And the pastor said, well, you know, why did you seduce him? You know, you're 18. He's, you know, married and 40. But why did you have sex with him? You know, calling it sex. It was rape, right? It was what we have to name it, what it actually is. You know, we have to begin to. That's why I'm so passionate about this work. I'm so passionate about actually beginning to tear down some of these systems, calling it for what it is. And it's hard. As a man, I have to do my own work first. I have to do my own deconstruction around my own sexuality, my own issues, before I'm actually going to see it clearly elsewhere. I have to realize that I'm part of the problem, right? I objectify women. I have to clean that up inside of me, my own pornographic mindset. I have to do that work first before I'm actually going to have integrity in the work moving forward.
I consider myself pretty romantic, and I would even say that my husband does a pretty good job of being romantic. And still, between him being a lawyer, me being an author, and us having two small kids and a dog and a cat and everything else going on in the world, it can sometimes be hard to connect. Enter the Paired app. My husband and I have started using this, and it's been a lot of fun. To use the app, you and your partner both download the app and then pair together. And every day, Paired provides the questions, quizzes, and games you need to connect with the person that you love. And the best part is that you don't even need to be in the same room to play. It takes 5 minutes a day. Let's be real. Date nights are big events. Sometimes it really is the small connections throughout the day that build a strong relationship. So check it out. We're loving it. We love that there are things that are touching, and there are things that are funny, and there are things that are even a little bit flirty. Share the love this Mother's Day by going to paired.com/struggle to get a 7-day free trial and 25% off if you sign up for a subscription. That's paired.com/struggle to sign up today. Let's give the gift of connection this Mother's Day. A happy relationship starts here.
A few weeks ago, my husband's beloved grandfather died, and it's been a really sad time for our whole family. But one of the moments of light in this whole process was shortly after he passed away, I got an email from my mother-in-law, and she had sent all of us a link to his Storyworth book. I don't know if you're familiar with Storyworth, but I have a new appreciation for them now that we have a Storyworth book on my husband's grandfather. Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. Storyworth makes the writing process a breeze. All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story, long or short, it doesn't matter. And then you get emailed a copy of their response as they're submitted in the course of a year. You'll get to enjoy the retelling of their stories that you already know or be surprised by stories you've never heard before. And after that year of fun, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. I am so grateful to my mother-in-law for doing this with her dad. We love it. Families love Storyworth. That's why it has more than 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, with millions of stories preserved since they were founded over 10 years ago. So Mother's Day is coming up, and I want to give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you will cherish for years. Right now, save 10% on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/struggle. That's storyworth.com/struggle to save $10 on your first purchase. Whether it's Mother's Day, Father's Day, or just because you know that sometimes time is short and you want to capture those memories.
Well, and it's the interesting part to me is that if you claim to follow Jesus, one of the most striking things about the story of Jesus is the inversion of the power dynamic between God and quote unquote God's subjects, right? And coming and being a servant and coming and washing feet and coming and saying, I'm not above you. And I feel like that is like the core from which all of this starts, is that men can't see the power dynamic that they're operating in. And even men who are trying to be good and they're trying to be godly and they're trying to, like, I've known men to genuinely look at the scripture and go, okay, it says that it's wrong that he did this, but it also says that we have to forgive. So like, we have to be exactly what the scriptures say. Like we have to be. And there's this sense of like, we're so obsessed with being quote unquote biblically accurate that if there was one woman in the room to just go, can y'all just zoom the fuck out for a minute? Like, you don't even see what you don't see. You don't see that, like, even if it's in black and white, the application of that in the context of a power dynamic changes what you should be saying and doing to people, which to me is so brilliantly illustrated in the picture of Jesus. I mean, the amount of times, you know, like my favorite story, of course, and whether, you know, when it got added is debatable, but is the woman at the well, right? Jesus shows up and everyone's got their stones and it's like, well, she's an adulterer. And like the text says, the scripture says to stone her. And I love that like his response isn't like, no, that's not what it says. Or like, no, you've misinterpreted it. His response is like, yeah, that's what it says. And if you think following that text right now is the godly thing to do, why don't you stone yourself, idiots? And I'm like, what? That seems so clear to me. Like, why do you not feel that that would be the appropriate way to approach any text when it comes to looking at a situation and using your God-given common sense to go, how do we handle this?
Yeah, that story, it's and that to me, that story partly makes me just continue to be a Christian. I mean, that story to me just blows my mind. I love that story. Breaking decades of prejudices and sexism in his own culture, literally. Real quick, I want to just read this quote about that story. This is from Catholic priest and blogger Angela Meyer. The rabbinic warning against contact with a woman of any kind was extreme. If speaking with a woman can cast one into hell, how much more drinking from the same cup? During a woman's period, any ritual objects she touches becomes impure, and those she encounters will also become impure. Basically saying that because, I mean, Jesus literally shared spit because he asked for a drink, like even sharing spit with this woman. So not only did he engage, you know, from a Samaritan woman, literally shared spit with her. I mean, how wild is that?
Yeah, the other one that I love is the Martha and Mary story, where Jesus is teaching and Mary is sitting at his feet to learn, which is like where disciples sit to learn from a master, right? And Martha is running around fulfilling her feminine duty. Like she is fulfilling her culturally prescribed, religiously prescribed gender role. She's getting the food ready. She's getting the drink. She's getting this. She's getting that. And Jesus stops her. And she gets on to her sister, right? Like, hey, get up. Like, I am doing this all by myself. Like, you're sitting there and listening. Like, we got to get snacks or whatever, right? And Jesus's response is like, no. She's doing the better thing, which is so countercultural.
So much so. Yeah, so
that she's allowed to be there, that she's allowed to listen, that she's allowed to learn, that she's allowed to do those things, and she doesn't have to get up and get snacks for the men.
Totally. Jesus's example, the woman in the alabaster jar, the Canaanite woman, Mary Magdalene, I mean, all these examples of the way Jesus valued women, to me, sets an example of how us as a church, right? I mean, literally, who does Jesus show up to first?
Yeah, like the first women, the first people to notice that he's risen from the grave is women. And the women go and tell the rest of them. And if you don't know that at the time, a woman could not be a witness in court because they're not deemed as reliable witnesses, that story isn't quite as astounding as it is. And these are the reasons that I stay. Like, outside the fact I couldn't probably make myself unbelieve if I wanted to, but like, those are the reasons I stay. Those are the reasons I cling. Like, those are the parts of sacredness that like my heart beats and says, yes, that's true. Yes, that's true.
And it's like, we can't escape Jesus's value of women. And again, where he was at culturally did not value women in that way.
Let me ask you this. One of the other things that you talk about is consent. And that is different than I've seen pastors talk about, and even God help us, Christian counselors, the amount of Christian men counselors that will approach the sex topic with couples with, well, you know, men need sex and like you need to give of yourself and scripture says. And I'm curious, like, what your approach with couples is when it comes to that.
Yeah. Healthy sex, and again, when I'm speaking of sex, I'll speak directly towards intercourse, whereas for me, sex is a much broader category than just intercourse, but we'll talk specifically towards intercourse. That should be an overflow of the connectedness of emotionality, emotional intimacy of connectedness, versus using sex as a way to connect intimately. Right? So you see so many people say, well, we're so disconnected, let's have sex. Well, no, it should be the opposite. Let's intimately connect, and then we'll see if that leads to more, you know, physical connection, right? Versus, no, you hear this excuse, well, men connect sexually. No, we don't. We connect emotionally as well. We just are unpracticed, right? And so we can't use that as an excuse. We don't need sex. We don't. Sorry. You want it. And you actually use it as a way to escape doing the hard work of emotional labor. And you just use it as a way, a cheap form of connection, right? Of just kind of getting off rather than actually connecting. So what we do in our men's work and our retreats, like we'll, you know, literally start on the first day and we'll put men 6 inches face to face. Right. And so we'll start there and we do what's called sentence stems. So I see in your eyes, and then they answer the question. I see fear. I see uncomfortableness. I see, you know, whatever, right? And we do that. And over the course of the weekend, my deepest shame is. And we practice eye contact. We practice these intense, quick sentences of getting quickly deep into. And by the end of the retreat, you know, we're doing it for forever. Eye contact, and we're very comfortable with intimacy and connection, and then realizing, oh, I've been so terrified of just being still with myself. I've just been so terrified of sitting and looking in my partner's eyes. But at the end of their retreats, men are so hungry for genuine intimacy. They no longer hunger for the false thing. They can't wait to get home and be with their partners and just like be with them and pursue them, and not just sexually. Right. We've somehow replaced and made this kind of cheap replacement of an orgasm as somehow the epitome of connection, when really men are craving deep intimacy and we're really just unpracticed. But I truly believe men are so much, you know, we like to treat them as little cavemen rather than like, no, actually, there's no difference between men and women as far as our craving. I truly believe we're unpracticed at it.
Yeah. They get told that they're going to be too gay if they're emotionally intimate.
Yeah, the weaponizing of the word gay as some, you know, I mean, growing up, that was like the biggest, you know, in the early 90s, that was like the biggest, you know, curse. Oh, you're gay. And so what did we learn? Whenever we face men to men, it's about competition, right? It's about dukes up rather than like, no, actually, I want to connect. I'm hungry for connection. I'm lonely. I'm craving connection.
Yeah. And that's if you are a straight person, not to mention the layers of shame that if you are actually gay and you hear it as an insult your whole life.
Exactly. Exactly. And that doesn't change. If you are gay, you are craving connection.
So Andrew, where would you send people if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, oh goodness, I think maybe my church is gaslighting me, or I'm worried that maybe I, you know, am not getting good information about my relationships, but they are wanting to still hear something from a faith perspective, you know, where would you send them? Do you have some resources?
Yeah. Love Sheila Gregoire's work. It's great. Her work is fabulous, really research-based. So follow her work. Let's see, who else? There's so many great people online now. Natalie Hoffman, Sarah McDougall, as far as abuse-informed work.
And your website is Andrew J.
Yeah, my blog, Andrew J. Bauman. And our business is, my wife and I run the Christian Counseling Center for Sexual Health and Trauma. And you can find us at www.christiancc.org. And I blog at andrewjbauman.com.
Yeah, you've got some great resources on here, and we'll put those in the show notes as well so that people can find the way to get there. Well, Andrew, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.